murder suicide is the kind of tragedy that leaves all of us asking why. That's what we're trying to do by talking to the people who've lived through it. Unlike the often sensational coverage of true crime in the media, the goal of our podcast is to provide our viewers and our listeners with an accurate and in-person look at murder-suicide, the risk factors, the personal experience, and the aftermath. On our podcast, the expert is the person who lived through it, the survivor. Welcome to the final act. I'm Dr. Joni Johnson, a forensic psychologist and private investigator, and I'm very happy once again to welcome my wonderful co-host, Jacqueline Jamison, who has been a mental health professional for the past 25 years and who lost her daughter to murder-suicide 10 years ago. So good to see you again, Jackie.
You too, Joni. Thank you so much. Great to be here. I wish it was a different topic, but I think this is something that we need to talk about and share with the world and say it more. We need to say these words more. As I was thinking about today and the wrap up that we're going to do, and we're going to talk about all of the experts we've interviewed, I was thinking the words murder, suicide aren't heard. You know, we're hearing suicide more out in the world, but we don't really hear murder, suicide. And there's kind of this, you know, I can feel it. I feel this tension when I say it even.
We certainly don't hear those words used together very often. And mm-hmm. we talked at our very first episode about kind of some of the reasons that we were doing this podcast and YouTube channel was to really, I guess for me, it was to understand it myself better. Also, you know, I had a family history of suicide, and I certainly can relate to that on a professional as well as a personal level. But in my research, I just kept coming across these news stories about murder-suicide involving families, involving children. And, you know, my concept of murder-suicide had been a mass shooting. You know, somebody who went into a school, who killed a bunch of people and then killed themselves. That was my concept of murder-suicide. And I think that's a lot of people's concept still. And while that is one form of, or one version, I guess, of murder-suicide, in reality, that is certainly not the most common.
Right, exactly. Those just happen to be the ones that we hear about the most, that make the media, the news the most, I think because so many people are impacted all at one time. But even then, we don't hear the words murder, suicide. What we hear is school shooting or mass shooting. And so I think this terminology needs to be one that we definitely use more so that we understand the underpinnings of it.
Absolutely. And one of the things that makes it hard is the fact that there is no national database on murder, suicide. So it's very difficult to gather those statistics and kind of talk about how common it is. I know I've found doing some of the research, trying to figure out as a starting place about murder, suicide is like, how common is it? The best estimates I've found is that between 1,000 and 1,500 people in the United States die every year by murder-suicide. And about 15% of those are children. And so while it certainly isn't a common occurrence, if you're tuned into the media, like I am in terms of doing research on these kinds of topics, it comes up over and over again, you know, multiple times a week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Unfortunately, only I would say less than 1% actually make big news or Netflix documentaries or things like that. You know, I think we can reference, you know, a recent case like the Gabby Petito case and those big ones, those are the ones that we hear about. But even then, it's not, you don't hear murder, suicide. You just hear, you hear the story, but I don't think that what we're doing is connecting the dots from the perpetrator to the victim and the survivors and the whole dynamic that's happening here.
I think you're right. I think there's a lot of work to be done in this topic. And I'm wondering what it's been like for you, Jackie, to go through this journey over the past 8 weeks and hear different experts sharing their personal stories. And hearing the different versions of how it impacted them and how it evolved and how they found out and just all the different things we talked about.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was actually thinking about that this morning as I was sort of preparing for us to talk today. And it has been really good for me to, I think, reconnect myself to different kinds of stories. And it's given me permission to sort of reopen or unpack what I went through in a different kind of way. And 10 years out versus maybe 5 years out is such a huge shift in how I think about things, how I process it, and even the grief that surrounds it. And also, I think, you know, my ability to kind of take a step back and look at trends and things like this, you know, the terminology, and maybe if there is something we can do. And I think we're just getting it out there. And, you know, I've been thinking about this over the years as I contemplate writing a book or telling my story, or, you know, just unsure about which direction to go. And David Kessler, who I don't know if you're familiar with David Kessler's work, but he worked with Kubler-Ross on the stages of grief. And he came up with what he wanted to be like the sixth stage of grief, which Kubler-Ross didn't fully buy into before she passed away. But his idea of the sixth stage of grief, which I fully agree with after going through this, is finding purpose, you know, in the loss. And so for me, going through this is just sort of reigniting my fire around finding purpose. And it has been very helpful for me in sort of picking back up where I left off several years ago when I just wasn't ready. And so I'm very grateful for you and the rest of the team and the Murder Suicide Loss Network and in the community that we have a safe space to do this.
Well, I really appreciate that, Jackie. And I tell you, I felt so honored these past 8 weeks because, you know, I just contacted this group out of the blue, really. I mean, I've written a couple articles about murder-suicide. I was like, what is going on? As a mental health professional, I never heard about murder-suicide. I think there's a potential for this, the risk factors to fall through the cracks, which is something we'll talk about. And I still think that. And, you know, I was just really amazed that there were so many people who were willing to trust me, not knowing me at all and what my agenda might be, certainly in the true crime space, and be willing to open up and come on and share such personal details and experiences. And I know I've said this before, I guess I feel a need to say it again, just how important it is for me to just hang on to these stories and take it forward in any other media work that I do, and just always be sure I'm always being as ethical as I can be and respectful and you know, victim-centered. And I mean, things that I aspire to anyway, but there's nothing like hearing people's stories to really hit that home because, you know, you've lived it, our other experts have lived it, and hearing that and hearing the emotion in the voice and just the memories is just so powerful.
It is. And, you know, I feel like we live in our story, every human being, we live in our story. And so I've gone through periods where I feel like who wants to hear this? You know, like what, how am I unique? And why would anyone care? You know what I mean? But what I've learned is by holding it in, it's almost kind of selfish because there are so many people that are impacted because it's not just the perpetrator and the victim, it's family members and friends. And the fallout from this kind of thing is far and wide, you know, communities, my whole church, for instance, was impacted. And so, holding it in and not sharing it really is a disservice, even though it's really hard sometimes to talk about it. And I've also had people say, you know, because I'm in recovery now, I participate in Alcoholics Anonymous as part of my recovery process from all of this. People say to me, wow, I really thought, you know, I had it bad, or I thought my situation with X, Y, or Z in my relationship was really bad. And I hear your story and you give me hope and you inspire me and I feel so much different or better or whatever it is, you know? And so I think that's too why it's important, because it's so relatable to people in terms of, well, so for me, when I see things that I haven't experienced, like war in other countries and things like that, I think, oh my gosh, those, you know, poor people, and how devastating it must be to grow up in that kind of environment or experience that kind of loss. It's the same kind of thing, I think, for us, for people who live a, you know, more comfortable life, or who haven't experienced this kind of trauma, to hear and think, I don't have it so bad.
You know, two things came to mind when you were talking, Jackie, that I wanted to ask you about. Is one is, you know, especially with you having shared your story, I wonder how you decide to share that story with somebody. And I wonder, I mean, I was just thinking, as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, even somebody kind of saying, how many kids do you have?
Right.
Like, how do you answer that question? And how do you know it's a safe space to talk to that person? And yeah, I mean, those are things I think that could happen regularly. And these are things that most people don't even think twice about. I have this many kids, or they don't think about, well, how do I navigate that? And how much do I share? And is it safe to share? And how do you make those decisions?
Well, now that I've aged a little bit, I don't get that quite as often. You know, since my son is now 21, but I still get it. But in the last 10 years, I have gotten that question a lot. You know, I'll say, oh, my son this, or my, you know, my kids that. Oh, really? How many do you have? How old are they? And it's an immediate gut punch. It's you know, the sinking feeling, and the, you know, my heart races, and it's kind of like an instant anxiety, right? And it really just depends on the moment, who's asking, where I'm at, how I'm feeling, how much time do I have. So in that moment, it just kind of happens, and either I share it or I don't. I think sometimes I was meant to share, because then I've had other people say to me, I lost my child too. They died of an overdose, or they this, or they that. And then they show me their necklace with their urn. Or their tattoo, or whatever it is, that where they memorialize their child. Now, it wasn't necessarily murder-suicide, but I've met many parents because of that. And sometimes I've said, oh, I have two children. I have two children, you know, one's here with me and one's in heaven. Oh, really? And sometimes they'll say, well, what happened? And I'll say, oh, it's really tragic. You know, if you want to know, I'll tell you. But earlier on, that was a lot more difficult, because I would just panic and leave, or not answer, or cry, you know, whatever it was. That was just really, really hard. And as the time has gone on and I've learned how to navigate that, of course, it's become a lot easier. And sometimes I would just say, I have one, he's 21, and I just leave it.
I think it's great to have that permission. I mean, it's your story, just like it's
right.
You know, our stories are our experiences, our own story, and we get to decide how much we share that or how little we share that with other people. But there are things that I think a lot of us don't think about on a regular basis. Those kind of just everyday questions people ask sometimes just to fill in the gaps or make conversation can be very difficult depending upon that person's experience in terms of how they answer that.
It's like any other trauma, really. You know, I just went to the grocery store before I came here, and I still get an empty feeling, or a, you know, sort of a little bit of a gut punch every time I go down a grocery store aisle with baby stuff in it, because my daughter was 2.5 and I felt like I didn't get to finish that cycle with her. And so those are the kinds of things, whatever the memories are, like any other trauma or post-traumatic stress, those things, you know, depending upon who were involved with, who your family member was, how it happened, what have you, of course. It's a daily grind, for sure.
You know, we were lucky enough to hear people who had different life experiences in terms of who the perpetrator was and who the victims was. And so I think that was so helpful to see that there is no one way to feel or one way to grieve, right, or things like that. And one of the things that did strike me is just different relationships that people had and such different feelings that people expressed about the family member who was the perpetrator. So, you know, we talked when Connie was on, I thought, you know, it was amazing to me to hear her story, but this is somebody who really felt more connected to her brother-in-law, who was the person who killed her ex-husband, than she did the victim. And so another, I think, interesting perspective in terms of talking about how this common term that we use, murder-suicide, is so unique for each person's experience. And it depends upon, like you said, so many factors in terms of those relationships and what actually happens.
Yeah, as a practitioner especially, or anyone, any lay person, really, I think we have to be very careful about assuming, because I felt myself, even during her interview, assuming that maybe there was guilt on her part about feeling okay with him and still having, she was as almost as if he helped the situation because her ex-husband, you know, she had domestic violence and different things that she experienced. And so I think we just have to be very diligent, especially as practitioners, to not assume that somebody feels any kind of way about a perpetrator in a situation where they were deemed the perpetrator.
Yeah, that's probably a better word for that than I'm using. I don't know what it would be.
I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's the murderer.
Yeah.
And so that word is very harsh and it's very demeaning and it's stigmatizing. And in our country in particular, that's a criminal. That person is like, probably that's the worst thing somebody can do. Right. Yet we have Connie here saying, I remember the good things. I don't know if she used the word blame. I don't blame him. I don't, you know, it just was what it was. And I was going to say the word shocked, but I was like, wow, okay, all right.
Well, I felt similarly. I did, you mm-hmm. know, when she first started talking about that, because again, we all assume that, you know, if there's a murderer and there is a victim, that of course it's black and white, right? It's that this is the bad person, this is the good person. And yet when you have situations where, I mean, and there's no doubt that taking another person's life is a bad thing, no matter what the circumstances are.
Right.
So I'm not in any way excusing anybody's behavior.
Sure.
There's so much pain and loss that was created. At the same time, you know, Connie's experience was very different than
sure.
other people's experience, and her relationship with each individual was different. And so to that extent, you're absolutely right. It's like in her mind, you know, as she said, she separates out to some extent, not completely, but the act or what happened with her relationship and her feelings about these individuals.
Right. For sure. Yeah. And I think it was Jenna was the other one who didn't hold blame for her brother. And that dynamic was similar. She said she felt some relief that what had happened, right? And so that's another scenario where we just have to honor the person's story and their feelings wherever they are. The day that we interviewed her, she mentioned the word relief, but that doesn't necessarily mean that later today or tomorrow she might not be angry at her brother. And so it depends on the moment as well.
Well, I think the other part of that, one of the things that was so unique about Jenna's story was just the prevalence of mental illness. Just the fact that her brother had struggled with mental illness for years and didn't want to take medication. And I think, and this is such a hard one, I think, as a mental health professional, that we talk so much about getting help and getting resources. And yet I'll tell you, as somebody with a family member who had bipolar disorder, my dad, what do you do when there is an
right.
adult who doesn't want to take medication. And part mm-hmm. of that illness is a lack of insight. And, right. you know, the person might go into the hospital, or you might be able to put this person in the hospital for 72 hours or 48 hours. And then the person's not actively suicidal or not actively homicidal. And it's like,
right.
it's so hard to talk about that reality, that it's hard to get help. I mean, it's hard to know what to do. And I remember, I think my remembrance, at least of Jenna's story, part of it is that she felt relief because she was so often in that caretaker role, I think, for yes. her brother. And also, I think, worried about her mom, and, you know, was aware that this could, not saying that this could happen, but aware that her,
right.
her brother might commit suicide, or was expecting that. And so all those feelings that she had
right.
about that relationship, and just, I mean, it just was so, you know, kind of heartbreaking, I guess, in a way.
Yeah.
Because sometimes those resources are just difficult to get. We have to, and there's going to be something there, you know, but I do want to honor that sometimes it is difficult to get resources in situations like that, when you have somebody who's not, for whatever reason, perhaps because of their mental illness, not aware of the problems they're actually having and creating for other people.
Right. Yes, for sure. And, you know, there are certain diagnoses and certain disorders that are I don't want to use the word dangerous, but definitely, you know, unmedicated can pose more of a risk to themselves and or others. But those typically are the ones that are the hardest to treat, because they typically are more non-compliant. And then we have a system, at least in America, that isn't necessarily set up for that, to care for those individuals in a way maybe that they need to be cared for. And so the families are left to sort of figure it out. And when you have a child or anyone in your family, anyone that you love, really, a partner, whoever, that is sick in that way, and they can't, for whatever reason, be compliant or don't want to as part of the disorder, what do you do, right? I mean, you love them and you do the best you can and you hope nothing bad happens, but sometimes this is what happens.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to be sure and talk about, we were planning for this and trying to think about all the things we wanted to say and communicate. And I guess two things are really important to me to talk about. One is risk factors.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that we heard so often from just about everybody, almost, that who came on and was our expert, was just this kind of link between domestic violence, coercive control, some kind of mm-hmm. abuse that was going on in their family, and murder-suicide. And I think that that's something that needs to really be talked about. That, you know, the awareness around domestic violence, interpersonal homicide, has become greater. I don't know that we've seen a lot of reduction in homicides as a result, but I think that the word is getting out there. People are talking about it and the risk factors. And yet I don't know that murder suicide is seen as a potential outcome of this. And I think it's really, really important for people to be aware of that. And also the fact that one of the things that struck me and doing some in some of the stories and doing some of the reading and those kinds of things is my concern being that the risk factors that are somewhat unique to murder-suicide, which we're going to be talking about, I think because they're this combination oftentimes, not always, but this combination oftentimes of mental health issues and domestic violence, I think sometimes different people may be assessing different parts of that elephant, if you will, and not nobody is seeing, or it's easy not to see what it really is, or that the risk is much greater than, you know, either person may be thinking of that. And I know, you know, as a mental health professional, somebody comes into my office, or used to, and I do my suicide risk assessment, and I ask, you know, are you thinking about hurting yourself or anybody else? And that's the extent of it, if the person's coming in with depression. And I think one of the takeaways for me, and I hope that mental health professionals who watch this our series is that if somebody's coming in and they're talking about depression and suicide and they're expressing those thoughts, and it's in the context, for example, of a relationship breakup, or it becomes clear that there's some coercive control that's gone in that relationship, we need to go much further than just talk yes. about, are you thinking about hurting somebody else? And I think there are ways we can ask those questions about, you know, when this person's depressed, do you ever get so depressed that you just feel like, you know, it's not worth it, or that you feel like your child couldn't live without you if something happened? Or, you know, maybe it's something along the lines of, you know, do you ever get so angry that you just feel like taking somebody with you? Or you, I mean, there's all different kinds of ways, but we need to be, I think, tuned in to the fact that, you know, unlike my training, which was like, okay, if the person's suicidal, they're never going to hurt anybody else. We now know that's not the case, that there is a, right. you know, not a, certainly not a perfect link, but there is a relationship between suicide and homicide. We need to be sure. And the flip side of that is that if I'm somebody who's working in a domestic violence situation or a coercive control situation, I need to be aware that, you know, if a perpetrator or an abuser is depressed or making threats to kill himself, that is a risk factor for murder suicide, not just for suicide.
Right. Exactly. It's so funny you say that. I was, you know, as you made the bullet points for today and I was reading through those, that definitely came up for me was, what can we do different, you know, as practitioners or even as family members to recognize the risk factors? What are the red flags? What are the trigger words? What's the checklist? You know, this person has domestic violence, a history of domestic violent acts, coercive control, maybe narcissistic personality. They have even intermittent substance use disorder. They have, you know, a history of maybe depression. They've, you know, talked about suicide ideation. Okay, maybe it's check, 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 two of the five and they're at risk, right? I think to take it one step further, I'm not sure we would know what to do with them. So, right, and even in a typical Baker Act, maybe they would be hospitalized for a few days, 24, 36, maybe 72 hours, and then they're back out. So I think at some point moving forward as well, in addition to that, those red flag triggers or whatever it is we talk about, how do we treat and what do we do and what kind of maybe boundaries do we put in place? And is there a restraining order and how, like, what is the next step? And I think, you know, we're stepping into sort of a big can of worms here because I don't know that we have enough trends to know even what to do. I also know that it's going to be important to get the people that have the information, like family members, to step up and speak out and not be afraid to tell on their family member. Or keep secrets. That was another trend we saw or we heard is, yeah, no one talked about it in public. No, I didn't go, like for me, for instance, after I separated from my partner, it was really rocky. And although there was just a lot of underpinning coercive control and manipulative types of behaviors and things to sort of get back at me. And we had had a murder-suicide in our community just months prior. And I said to one of my friends, it hit me out of nowhere. And I said, you don't think she would do that, do you? This was like 2 months before my ex committed the act. And so the person I was with said, oh gosh, no, we're not, no. You know, I don't think that could ever happen. But the fact that I had that intuition or the wherewithal to even think that, my message is, if you think that, then something inside of you is telling you that that's real. So what's the worst that can happen? You're wrong. Okay, so you're wrong. But it could save lives.
That is such a powerful comment that you made, because one of the things that we talked about, and thank you for sharing that, Jackie, because you didn't even share that in telling your story a few weeks ago.
Right.
Because one of the things we talked about before is the fact that, there, you know, everybody, well, a lot, several people talked about just being absolutely stunned when they found out what happened. I mean, just completely stunned. And yet, some of our guests said, I had no idea this would ever happen. And yet, the minute I found out there had been these murders, immediately I knew what had happened.
That it was, their person.
Yeah. I knew it was this person had done it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how do we make sense of that? And you just gave an amazing example of, on some level, there was a part of you that was scared, that was worried, that saw this as a possibility. And of course, I would imagine anybody would be like, oh, Jackie, no, of course that would never happen, because we think it would never happen to us or anybody that we know or care about.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the fact that that wasn't the only time that I kind of got that, because there was one time where she said, hey, I want to take both of the kids, for several weeks to the summer to a different state to see family or whatever by herself. And I immediately was like, no, because somewhere in there, I felt like this was sort of some planned scheme, right, of hers to take them away from me somehow, some way. And it did cross my mind, her driving into the water or whatever as a way to sort of get back at me. And so it was more than once. And so one of the things that, and I had premonitions too about my daughter passing away prior to that. I had these premonitions. I didn't know what to do with all of that. I thought people would think I was crazy. And it wasn't because of anything that she said or did directly up towards them. It was just this gut thing. And we ignore that way too much. And I think we would hear that from some of our guests too, that came on.
I think so too. And I think that your question about what do we do? So let's say that we take this seriously and we think, okay, this could happen. You're right. What do we do? The question is, what do we do with this person? And it may be we can't do anything with this person necessarily. It may become, what do we do to protect ourselves?
Exactly.
And as you pointed out, if it's not true, if it's not going to happen, if whatever it is, that's the worst case scenario, that we're taking extra precautions because we're concerned about it. I mean, I think anybody that we've ever had on this podcast, anybody we'd ever talked to would be like, I will trade that. I will trade that possibility for the other possibility that I ignore this voice, I ignore this concern, and something horrible happens.
Right. And what just came into my mind was, okay, so, we had separated, she had lost her job. She kind of was without, she was experiencing all of this loss, and essentially that plus, prescription medications and mental health and the course of control personality stuff, like that's our plus, 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 plus equals. The only thing that I think would have happened is she probably would have taken her own life. But had I taken the control back and not allowed her to see the kids, I would have dealt with backlash. I would have had to go to court. I would have had to do all of these things. But my daughter might still be here. So, it's hard. And what if I'm wrong? And what if they still kill themselves? Okay, but you're maybe protecting another person from taking them with them. And then there's like weapons and things like that. Safeguarding maybe the person, taking away their means to hurt themselves or someone else. But you know what? Then there's
LaToya.
I'm sorry. LaToya. I don't know that she really had that thought, right? I don't know that she had the plus, plus, plus.
Yeah, I don't think necessarily. I mean, I think it's, again, when we talk about risk factors and, I mean, we know a couple of things. I think we know at this point that it's not inevitable, that there are situations where people have thought about it and it didn't happen. There's been some intervention. Right. So I think this myth that murder-suicide is inevitable in certain situations, I don't think it's true. It doesn't mean, though, I think that everybody's going to pick up on something. Everybody's going to have some, foreshadowing or some warning signs or whatever. And if you don't, you miss something. Because I think there are situations, and I know in the situation with LaToya, I think the fact that it was her father may have been something that, she wasn't around his father as much. And I think fathers and daughters, well, fathers and children, parents and children have a different relationship. So I can see in a way how it might be different or more difficult in some situations to pick up on those warning signs, because you're still seeing your parent as, you know, your hero or whatever. You're not thinking along those lines. Now, I know Mitch with his dad, he did say, if I'm remembering correctly, that he never, ever thought his dad would do that. And yet he was one of the ones who said when he found out that there had been, you know, these deaths, he immediately thought his dad had killed his mom.
Right. So somewhere inside. And so I think part of this, thinking about how do we find it? How do we see it? How do we talk about it? And how do we treat it is, teaching people maybe how to listen to that instinct or whatever. But I think also people who are feeling suicidal or have had these thoughts, I think the last thing someone wants to do is say, I've had thoughts about hurting myself and someone else or taking this person with me because I'm angry and that scares me. I don't know that I've ever heard that in 25 years.
I think it's difficult to talk about that. I do. And, but I have to say, and it's been a while since I've been a clinical psychologist as opposed to a forensic psychologist, but I have definitely heard people talk about those thoughts of, you know, hurting somebody else or fantasies of hurting somebody else. And I think it's hard to, I think part of the problem still is that a lot of people feel like if I go somewhere and talk about these thoughts I'm having or these urges, I'm going to be put away. I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to be whatever. There's a lot of fantasies about that. And I think we need to create a safe space for somebody to be able to talk about things, because we all know that when things are locked inside and we can't talk about them, it's like they fester and grow.
Right.
And we take them out and the light is can shine on them, I think then we are able to see things a little bit more clearly. But I think a lot of times, you know, there isn't that kind of permission to talk about things, you know, because thoughts have never hurt anybody. Fantasies have never hurt anybody. It's the actions, you know, which kind of brings me to another thing that I wanted to get your input on, Jackie, because I know you've not only experienced this, but you work with people who've experienced this. There's a concept that I come across a lot in kind of workplace violence assessment or threat assessment, which is kind of this last resort behaviors, looking for the last thing, the last straw almost in a way. I mean, when I say last straw, I don't want to mean that somebody snaps, because I think one of the myths about murder-suicide is that a person snaps. And I don't think that's the case. I think it's oftentimes it's planned out on some level.
Over time.
Yeah. It's the person's been thinking about it for a period of time. But but there is this idea of kind of this last resort. And I'm wondering if you see any application, because it's one thing to talk about risk factors, like if there's, you know, an ongoing domestic violence situation or coercive control or there's, you know, alcohol or drugs involved or, you know, some of the things that we're talking about. But are there things that you've seen working with your clients or that you noticed looking back that were almost like that last resort? The person became so desperate, or this happened, or this person said this, that would kind of be like almost like the last flag.
I mean, oftentimes it's threats made aloud. You know, if you leave me, I'll kill you. and the person may not believe it. Or if you, I think we have to pay attention more to what people say, because I think there are subtle clues and we poo-poo it. That'll never happen. They'll never do that. Oh, you're just talking. I think even LaToya said that. Oh, because he mentioned, oh, I just go jump off a bridge, and then he ha 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 joke about it. Those things, we need to take those things more seriously and say, now, wait a minute. So I think oftentimes we just don't want to hear it. So I do think that there's that last thing. It's so funny. I would say probably a good 6 or 8 months prior, you know, to my own trauma too, we were watching a show that we regularly watched, and it was sort of like a dramatic true crime kind of thing. And my ex actually said to me something about, well, if something were if something were going to happen and somebody else was going to take our kids or whatever, would you just take their life knowing they wouldn't have to go live, you know, and be living with someone else? And I was like, no, like why? And so there are subtle hints. There are subtle clues. I know I ignored for a long time. So there's that. And again, I think I said this when I was sharing my story, like my ex actually told her family she was having these thoughts. And I didn't know that until after the fact. So I believe we need to pay more attention.
I do too. And I also think what you said is so kind of resonates with me and looking more at just the homicide literature, like not looking at murder-suicide, but I think there's a complete parallel there. And that is oftentimes you'll see in interpersonal homicide, it's like when the person finally realizes this person isn't coming back, or it's a custody issue and there's been this battle and the person's now realizing finally that they're going to lose custody. Or it's like this awareness. You know, I remember a case where this man was, you know, they'd been this kind of ongoing, off and on again relationship. And really it was just the woman was trying in her best possible way to let this person down easily, which was not the best thing to do. It was the kindest thing to do, but it certainly wasn't the best thing for her at all, because she really didn't want to be with this person. And so she met with him a couple of different times. And it was only when, and nothing happened. This person was sweet, kind, but it was only when this person finally realized that he wasn't going to get her back. And I remember when we had Dustin on the show, and he was talking about his sister and how her ex had literally lured her by saying, I owe you this money for a rent. You've been paying for this house. Would you come over? And, you know, and it was then that he, you know, ended her life and ended his. It was like this right. finality that he realizes that she's moved on.
Right. And I think that does happen a lot in relationships when there's a murder suicide in a relationship, or just a murder or a homicide in a relationship, because that person realizes. And that was my case, too. You know, there was a realization, this is done. You know, this is over. And I think that definitely is a huge risk factor. I'm curious, from a forensic place, I know you said you haven't practiced in a long time, but did you hear people who maybe had these tendencies? And I don't know how you would diagnose that as psychopathy or sociopathy, or how, you know, because I'm not familiar with that field of study. But do you believe that those traits are also found in these people who are committing murder suicide?
So,
in other words, somebody who's going to, you know, kill somebody else but not kill themselves versus the murder suicide part.
I think that's a good question. And I actually have heard more stories about this in a forensic setting, which I am very actively practicing. So the clinical part of it has been a while, but I definitely, you know, I interview, you know, inmates all the time as part of risk assessment and those kinds of things. And so I've definitely heard a lot of different stories of, you know, leading up to a murder. And I think that what I would say is that the biggest differentiator that I see between, for example, interpersonal homicide, somebody who just kills their girlfriend or their spouse, right, or their husband or boyfriend or whatever, and somebody who commits murder suicide, is this depressive component, this depression. And I think
not a random murder. We're not talking about random murders.
We're talking about domestic violence, homicide, you know, interpersonal homicide. Okay. I just killed my spouse. I just killed my boyfriend or girlfriend, or I kill my boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, spouse, whatever, and myself. Is more the depression part piece of it. I think right. You can have some of the same personality characteristics. You can have some the same personality traits in both, because I think there is a certain amount. I mean, when you think about it, I think oftentimes, this is going to sound maybe odd, but there seems to be this unhealthy dependency oftentimes And there's a certain almost narcissism in a negative way. Like this person thinks I can't live without this person. And this person doesn't have the right to leave me in a way.
So my heart just dropped because for me, that's completely 100% accurate for my ex. 110% accurate. Totally.
I've seen that. I'm not saying that you can't find psychopathy. You can find probably whatever you're looking for, depending upon who you're evaluating. But I do see oftentimes, like I said, this unhealthy attachment or dependency. And along with that, this kind of, like I said, this kind of narcissism where, you know, I need you so much. I'm so dependent on you in some way that you don't have the right to, you know, to leave me or be a separate,
how dare you.
Or be a separate person from me. Yeah, exactly.
Right. That it's almost enmeshment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. I'd like to talk about that more at some point. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like we just really started. I mean, there's so many things to talk about. And one of my regrets about this series is that we weren't able to find somebody who was comfortable coming on and talking about, you know, maybe having a child who was the murderer. Because I think that person is a victim as well.
Oh, absolutely.
And it kind of breaks my heart in a way, because I think there's so much shame oftentimes attached and guilt attached to that. And yet I think to be able to provide that perspective would be so invaluable in terms of,
I'm thinking, especially if it's a child of theirs, an adult child, even,
yes.
You know, if they have committed a heinous crime, somehow they think it's their fault.
Yeah. And I think there is so much, it's like, it's so sad to me that, you know, one person's crime in a family can just spill over hot grease onto the rest of the family who had nothing to do with it. The other thing that I definitely want to talk about, and I know this is something that really hits home for you because you've said this, is just the impact on children who have lost a parent or lost a sibling. And what would you as a parent and a survivor recommend for children? What do you see? What have you seen? How do you help that child navigate the world after this? Like, talk to them. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have my own experience. We also heard Connie talk about her children and how they were impacted by the loss of their dad and their uncle, who they, you know, both admired for different reasons. But then there's sort of, so my son was 10 when the attempt was made to take his life, and you know, the fact that he was there and pulled my daughter out of the tub, and you know, lost not only a parent, but her entire side of the family. I mean, her and I were together 20 years. He was 10. He knew nothing but us and our families, and so he lost that entire side of the family in just a series of hours. You know, when you're a child and you experience something so tragic, that just kind of rips your whole, you know, your whole life apart. And one day you're normal and doing these things, and the next day it's completely different. And so, I guess as a parent who lost a child, who's raising a child who experienced the trauma as well, as you can imagine, that dynamic has been very much a strain, you know. In the beginning, I was lucky enough to have people who were there for me that helped me kind of take care of him so that I could go take care of myself. But over the years, even to this day, when I see him, for me, there's that connection to the crime and what happened and the guilt that I face about not being able to protect him or my other child. And then leaving him in a situation that, you know, was dangerous. And of course I didn't know, but leaving him in that situation and then trying to parent him and raise him while, and be a parent while, understanding, especially because I'm a therapist, but understanding the trauma piece. And so it's a lot to sort of, separate, I guess. And so I think it's really important for people who are experiencing this and they still have children to raise to just get support, find support, use your community, go to therapy, you know, whatever it takes, like it takes a village. You know, for me, it was my pastor, it was my friends, it was my family, it was his teachers, it was guidance counselors. Like I just really relied on my community and leaned heavily on them until I could get my feet under me. And even now, you know, when I have those moments, I allow myself to break, you know, for however long. And then I kind of put myself back together, but I have people that I can rely on. I don't know if you don't have that kind of support system, I say, seek it out, you know, find it. It's through victim services or support groups or kind of like the support group here, but find your people because it's not something we can do alone. And these kids that have experienced this deserve us to be present. And they deserve the help too. So it's definitely, it's a challenge. It's a day by day situation.
I can't even imagine. I was going to say, I can only imagine, but I can't even imagine. One of the things Connie said that really resonated with me, and I would think with children would be something that could really help parents who've had a child go through an experience or a family, a part of a family, is, you know, she talked about, you have to pick your why. And my interpretation of that, which may or may not be accurate from what she's talking about, is almost like, we're never going to really know exactly why this person made this decision.
Right.
What we can do is help our child figure out a why that's not about him or her. And because we all know children, even I think adult children, our parents do stuff. It's like, but especially as younger children, it's always about them. You know, that's just being a child. It's if my parent acts weird, I've done something wrong. I mean, there's just that natural sense that children take
why
on
me?
That stuff. Exactly. Why me? What did I do? Why did my mom or dad do this? Or why did they? And so I think that would be something that, I mean, would be an ongoing process. And I would imagine at different ages would need to have to be revisited and all that. But helping that child figure out, or even as a family, deciding. That the why we're going to decide upon, since we don't know, is going to be empowering for us.
Yeah. And I think just encouraging the child to like give them the power back to explore that, let them have their anger in an appropriate way. For me, it has been, I shielded him from, because she's in prison for life. So I shielded him. When he was younger, said, I want to see her. He was very angry. And I said, when you're 18, if you still want to see her, then that is up to you. Once he reached 18, he went through phases where he said, I want to see her. And then he said, what's the point? And now he's kind of accepted the fact that it's not going to change anything. But I think children we need to give them the space to come up with their own why and their own finding purpose. And I think that takes a very long time. I think Connie mentioned that her son actually was talking about helping people working in the field, right? Of mental health and behavioral health and maybe that's his why. And then her daughter is very much kind of the opposite right now, but she's younger. My son does not want his life to be, at least at this point, does not want his life to be defined by what happened to him. And so I keep saying, you know, because he's in the arts, and I said, use your trauma, use your experiences in the arts. You know, people need to hear your story. It's going to really save someone's life. And you know, for him, that's not what he wants his life to be about. And so I just have to respect that. And it's hard because I feel like he's experiencing denial and lack of acceptance. But that it's his journey.
And it is, I told Connie this, I know during the podcast, but I think, you know, giving children that space to have their experience and make those choices and knowing they may change their mind, they may not change their mind, but that's I think one of the biggest gifts as parents we can give anyway. So I know that I want to talk about the Murder-Suicide Loss Network, but I do want to bring up one more thing before we start wrapping things up. And that is the fact that we did see, a couple of experts who had law enforcement backgrounds in their family.
Oh, right.
And I just felt like that's something, it may just be that, you know, our experts just happen to have that background. But I know when doing some reading on this topic and preparing for this episode, there certainly is statistically a greater prevalence of domestic violence and interpersonal homicide, as well as murder-suicide in certain occupations, including law enforcement. And so I think the reason I want to bring that up is because we did have two of our experts have that in their background. And the fact that when Bruce came on talking about how that can impact the aftermath and the investigation, and we haven't spent a lot of time in the series talking about that part of the journey, right, the immediate aftermath of that. And so what was that like for you, Jackie, in terms of not obviously the law enforcement piece of it, but just the immediate aftermath and investigation, if there was one, and how you felt you were treated, yeah, and all those things?
Well, the system's definitely not set up to, I think, help the victims. There is a victim advocate that's assigned when things are, you know, right after they happen. And of course, that's federal funding. We don't know what's going to happen with that right now. But there are things in place to help the victim. But in terms of, like, in my case, I spent 4 years going through the court process because we were headed towards trial and the death penalty that was determined by the state of Florida. So the victim really doesn't have a lot of, I guess, rights. And that's something that I was a part of sort of helping to change, at least initially. There is something now called Marcy's Law in Florida where victims have certain, you know, rights. And I wasn't the one to put that bill forward, but I definitely supported it early on. But I think, you know, in the beginning, really, it's just a matter of survival. So the media, you know, in certain cases, you're being just washed over with the news and the newspapers, and you feel like everyone around you knows everything about you, and you feel naked and you feel vulnerable. But then you're dealing with, you know, the coroner, and how are you going to take care of the services, and what, you know, who are we going to invite? And, you know, so the first month or so is just around, like, just getting through all of that. And then once the people start to kind of go away and reality sets in, I think is really the hard part. And I would say, you know, the first year is sort of like the new normal, just getting used to that. And then I had people tell me, oh, the first year is hard, but the second year is harder. And I believe that. I believe that year two is even harder because there's like this acceptance that starts to set in. And with that comes the fear, I think, of forgetting, you know, your loved one. In my case, like, I had 4 years of court. So every time I went to court, I had to face her and the story all over again. So my healing process took much longer. But for people who don't have to deal that, they can, you know, get on the way of healing. But it is definitely life altering. It turns it's like taking a puzzle you spent your life sort of putting together, and you're getting this clear picture of what you think it's going to be, and it's pretty. And somebody comes in and just, you know, messes it up and tosses all the pieces all over the place. And, you know, to be honest, some of those pieces are never found. And so, you know, I have maybe a piece from a different puzzle that kind of fits, but it doesn't really go. But there are pieces that definitely just aren't put back. But I think the beauty in that is, I think there's some saying, I think the Japanese, I can't remember the name of it, but when a bowl breaks, they don't throw it away. They glue it back together with gold, and they treasure it. And it's this beautiful piece of art. And so I think that we just need to kind of remember that when we feel so broken that it's irreparable. It's not. We just have to, you know, we have to find the glue, give it time to set and dry, and, you know, then we can sort of come back and say, you know what, you know, that's not such a bad piece of art. So that's kind of how I try to look at it sometimes when I'm having a hard time.
I love that. I really do. Tell me about your experience with the Murder Suicide Laws Network and what your thoughts are about that for anybody who's gone through a similar experience.
I've heard this a lot, that people who experience murder-suicide, they go online, they Google murder-suicide, and there's not a whole lot that comes up except for more crimes or crimes that have happened maybe in your area. And it took me a good 9 years, 9.5 years, I guess, to find the Murder Suicide Loss Network. And I think they've been around for 5 years, Mitch said now. So the Murder Suicide Loss Network .com, I think, or .org. I think it's .com. And we'll post all that stuff at the end here. Is an online support group, and it's twice a week. And, you know, they just take your information. You can go online, put your information in there, and they will call you back. And they just talk to people. When Mitch said, oh, we interview people before they come in, I thought, what do you mean interview people? You know, I was all nervous. And why do you have to interview me? Like, you want to hear my story before my story? What is the, I felt weird about it. And now I can appreciate it because they want to create a safe space for people to come in, and they want to make sure that you're ready. And because sometimes in the beginning, we think we're ready, but then hearing other people's stories is so overwhelming and so triggering that it can, you know, kind of throw you backwards in your healing, in your recovery process. So that's kind of how they do things. It has been really good for me. There are days, there are times I don't want to go to support group because I just don't want to dig that back up. I'm in a good space and I just don't feel like it. And that's okay too. You can come when you feel like it. You don't have to come when you don't feel like it, but it's been the first thing in 10 years that I have found that I really feel like people understand what I've been through and I don't have to explain it.
Yeah, I can't think of anything that would be more healing than being with people who truly can, even though their experience is unique in their own life, they truly can say, I understand what you're going through. We've gone through something that few people will ever go through. And that must be, I get to see how that must feel so supportive.
It does. It makes us feel a little normal, I guess, as much as we can, because when I do tell my story out in public, it's this, oh my gosh, I cannot imagine. I can't imagine going through that. I'm so sorry. And it's like this, they're just aghast, you know? And we don't experience that in the group. It's like, I get it. I understand. It's okay that you feel this way, you know?
Well, we've talked about our experts that have come on for the past 8 weeks, and you have been our resident expert as a co-host, as somebody with a lived experience. So I think it's only fitting that you kind of wrap things up for us. So
yeah, sure.
So if there's, I guess if there's, is there any final word, Jackie, that you think would be important to say before?
Yeah. You know, we didn't get to talk in depth about the officers and the law enforcement and the domestic violence around that. But our last guest, Bruce, did go into that. And so just, I would encourage you, if you're watching this and you missed one of the stories, to go back and watch Bruce's, watch his podcast where he talks about the IOD. I think it was the IOD. It's an organization that has, you know, is basically, or a series of policies that are put in place to sort of, find domestic violence, maybe personalities or histories or things like that in law enforcement so that they can kind of catch it before it happens. So I guess to wrap up, I hope that everyone has an opportunity to go and listen to the rest of the stories. And if you're interested in telling your story and, or you want to share or you have questions, definitely you can reach out to us and our information will be posted, I assume, Joni. And and you know, maybe there's more to come here, maybe not necessarily associated with Murder Suicide Loss Network, but you know, separate from that, we don't know where this might go. So we're going to kind of leave it open and leave it out there, and we'll see what happens. So thank you everyone for being a part of this journey and taking time to listen. And thank you, Joni and Joe, who's in the background. Who created the ability for us to do this podcast online and do all of the editing.
Absolutely.
And thank you to all of our experts.
Yes, especially our experts.
All right. Well, thank you everyone so much, and take care.